I'm Patricia Pierce. Welcome to the Evolutionary Activist Podcast. We are living at an important moment in our history, a time that is calling us into a new way of being, a new consciousness from which a sustainable, just, and peaceful future can arise. In this podcast, we explore ways to help that future take hold within ourselves so that together we can help it come forth in our world. Our guest today is Eileen Flanagan, the award-winning author of three books and many articles. Her books include her memoir, Renewable, which tells the story of how she came to be involved in nonviolent action on behalf of climate justice, and her earlier book, The Wisdom to Know the Difference, When to Make a Change and When to Let Go, was a Nautilus Book Award winner and was endorsed by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And in addition to helping people make their own activism more effective through her online courses, Eileen speaks to international audiences on how to build a spiritually grounded and effective climate justice movement. For 5 years, she has served as board chair of Earth Quaker Action Team, which has successfully pressured one of the largest banks in the U.S. to stop financing mountaintop removal coal mining. So Eileen, welcome and thank you so much for being with us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Patricia.
So I'd like us to start off. I've read your memoir, Renewable, so I know some of the backstory, but maybe you can share with our listeners what led you to become involved in nonviolent action.
Well, there were a few things. First of all, I had done different kinds of activism over the years. Writing letters to congresspeople, signing petitions, making phone calls, going to big national marches. And over time, I felt more and more disempowered by some of those activities. We've been thinking a lot about gun violence recently. I organized a bus to go to the Million Mom March when my kids were very young, probably not quite 20 years ago. And afterward, felt really discouraged because nobody reached out to me after the march to say, these are the next steps. This is how we're going to build pressure on this issue. It seemed like a one-time thing. And so as my kids became less and less enthralled with going to this sort of thing, I kind of dropped off doing it. At the same time, I had this growing concern about climate change. I'm a Quaker, and one of the phrases that we use is, I felt under the weight of this issue, like there's something I'm supposed to do about climate change, there's something I'm supposed to do about climate change, but that sense of calling didn't come with specific instructions,
right?
And it wasn't clear to me what in the world I was supposed to do. But it was following an intuition one day. I had a really strong sense that I needed to go to the Philadelphia Flower Show of all places. If your listeners don't know of it, it's this big chaotic scene inside a convention center where they plant all these beautiful gardens inside a convention center.
Right. And people elbow their way through. Yeah,
exactly. It's really crowded. And I got down there. I was like, why am I here? And then I stumbled onto some of my Quaker friends who were involved with this group, Earth Quaker Action Team, were having an action in the middle of the flower show. They were singing, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? In the middle of this scene, to pressure PNC Bank, which was one of the big financiers of the flower show, while also being a major financier of mountaintop removal coal mining. And there was something about seeing this group that seemed so joyous and grounded and at the same time really serious and bold in pushing for a policy in the bank's lending, a policy change, that I just thought, okay, there's something here for me. There's this combination of bold action and spirituality and creativity and fun.
Yeah, so I'm hearing you say a couple of really interesting things in terms of feeling that you are under the weight of this issue. And so of all of the issues that you could have been engaged in, this was the one that was weighing on you, weighing on your heart.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, because there's lots of things I agree with or care about. It was particularly the justice part of climate change. I had known about climate change for a while, as you know from my memoir, Renewable, I was in the Peace Corps in Southern Africa, in Botswana. And it was as I started to learn about the impact climate change was having in Africa, in Botswana, around the world, in countries that were not the primary contributors to greenhouse gases, that the connection between this and justice really hit home. That as an American, I had a special obligation, and especially as an Irish American whose ancestors fled famine, reading about how climate change was causing more famine just really hit me in the gut.
Yeah. So it was both your personal history in Africa as a Peace Corps volunteer and your ancestral history of your ancestors having experienced some sort of climate disaster that those things also might have contributed to why this issue was really uniquely heavy for you.
That's right. And I would also add being a parent. When my daughter was born, she wouldn't go to sleep unless I drove around in a car. Uh-huh. And I remember, you know, she's 21 now, thinking like, this is probably not good for that global warming thing. But at that time, you know, global warming didn't really feel real yet. Like I knew the theory.
Yeah.
But I think that's another thing that's changed over recent years. It's become more and more palpable, the fact that we've changed the climate. And so that combined with having children who hopefully will outlive me, and then at the same time reading the projections for the 21st century, it was all of those things combined, I think.
Yeah. Another thing that you mentioned earlier on that took you to the flower show was following your intuition. And I've talked in previous podcast episodes about intuition as being one of those, what I refer to as evolutionary ways of knowing, but stepping out of our rational mind, because as a spiritual person, you are also presumably very attuned with this larger reality that we're part of. And none of us can see the whole picture. And so I find that intuition is one of the ways that sometimes I can navigate in ways that I can follow that intuition and end up doing things that don't make rational sense, but in the end, they make complete sense. And so it sounds like you were really tuned into that and you were following your intuition to go to the flower show, even though it's like, what? But that was the beginning for you, right? That was the moment when you became involved in this issue.
Yeah, that's right. And it's also part of what I appreciate about the group that I work with. I think that the fact that there's a spiritual basis, that there's a respect for intuition, and at the same time, a respectful critical thinking and studying the history of social change and what generally works, and bringing those two together. Let me give you an example, actually, of intuition in campaigning. I mentioned that when I met up with Earthquaker Action Team at the Flower Show, they were trying to get PNC Bank to stop financing mountaintop removal coal mining. That whole campaign lasted about 5 years. And so I got involved. I ended up becoming the board clerk. And it was in the summer of 2014, I had an intuition that we were going to win that campaign. Mm. I just had this sense. There was no sign really from the bank that they were willing to change policies. But there were just a few little clues combined with a gut sense. And so I said to George Lakey, one of our founders and former board members, I think we're going to win, and I think we should start talking now about what we're going to do next. Because a lot of times a group that's focused on one thing, especially in progressive politics, I think we have such a mindset sometimes of defeat.
Right, yeah.
That when people actually get the thing that they were trying to accomplish, then the group kind of can fall apart or spin its wheels for a long time. Like, oh my gosh, they did what we wanted? Wait.
And then everyone's at a loss for how to handle that and what to do next.
Exactly. And I had this strong sense that we should avoid that by starting to talk now about what we're going to do when we win this campaign. And a few people looked at me like I was crazy, but said, okay, Eileen has an intuition, we should do this. And so we started, we planned a series of discussions sort of dreaming into what that might be. And I believe it was after the first of those discussions that we got word that, in fact, it was true that PNC was announcing this policy change. And we needed a few more months to finish this process of deciding what was next. But the fact that we had already started it ended up being so helpful in that transition. And the things that came up in that very first meeting about what was on people's hearts that they wanted to do next are exactly the things we're doing now. So that just affirmed that intuition is not just an individual thing. It can actually really help our social change work.
Yeah. So along the way, I'm hearing you talk about a great deal of focus. I think one of the things that often happens with groups is they become very diffused and they try to take on a lot of different things. But it sounds like you all really do focus on one particular thing. Can you speak more about that?
Yeah, that's been a really important change for me and part of what has made me more optimistic about change. Because as you say, my history of activism was basically protesting whatever was in the news most recently, you know, like the gun violence march, which is an important issue. But then the next thing I went to was on some different issue, which was also important. But you don't really create the conditions for change that way. So Equate was founded with this very strong principle of we focus on a campaign. And we see the bigger picture, which if you think back to the civil rights movement, is really how they operated. The Montgomery bus boycott was just focused on the buses, even though there was tons of segregation around town, tons of other injustices. Mm-hmm. But they did one thing at a time. And in that way, they were able to shift institutions. And so, we're now in our second campaign. We understand how our campaign is connected to other campaigns and try and be in good communication with people doing related things and not have a sense of competition about that. But one of the real disciplines for me is learning to say, no, I cannot do everything. I cannot go to every march. I cannot, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because each of us has our own, you know, we have limitations of time and energy. So I appreciate that. And so if we're always chasing the latest headlines, you know, the latest headlines are always changing. And the way you describe this is, I think it's so helpful because it's not about trying to change the whole system. It's focusing in on one place, I presume, where you believe that change could occur. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of acupuncture, where you focus in on one particular place where the energy can be shifted.
That's a great analogy. That's really interesting. And you're absolutely right. The way I think of it is, what's the biggest change that we actually think is possible? And then who are the people who could help make that change happen? What are the leverage points that we might have? Where are the places to apply pressure? And so it's not pie in the sky, but it is kind of radically optimistic in a way. There was during that transition period where we were choosing a second campaign, I got an email from a Quaker somewhere who said, could you work on eliminating the U.S. military because they contribute so much to climate change? And I just kind of laughed. I was like, well, good point. Yeah. That is beyond my ability.
Yeah. Good luck. Good luck with that one.
Right.
Yeah.
But we did take on a huge corporation, which some people think was overly optimistic. But again, it's like, how do you sense you know, I think we can make a change here.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so much about what you're saying that I love. And one of the terms that you've just used of being radically optimistic is a great one. And then earlier when you were talking about being in the flower show and really being inspired by the joyfulness of the group and their boldness. So it's like this bold joy that believed that, you know, this power structure could be confronted in a positive kind of a way.
Yeah, I think that's especially true for the kind of campaigning that we do. If you think back to the civil rights movement, a lot of the most iconic images were a very particular kind of nonviolent direct action, a non-cooperation with injustice. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, the law says it's illegal for a Black person to order a cup of coffee at Woolworths, so Black people are going to go in, sit down, and order a cup of coffee, right? It was illegal to swim on certain beaches, so people are going to go walk into the water. And that kind of direct action, which is really flouting injustice in a very direct way, has an innate power to it. Mm-hmm. The kind of work that we're doing around climate change, our focus has been on corporations. We're not living on the front lines of where, you know, the tar sands are being developed, or we're not living in mountaintop removal coal mining country here in Philadelphia. There's plenty of injustice, but the campaigns that we've taken on are kind of more wonky, to be honest. You know, getting a bank to stop lending money, which is all going to move electronically. Like, there's no way to interrupt that. Right. And our current campaign is getting our utility, PICO, to make a major change and move towards solar and invest in solar jobs. And so, again, it's we're moving where the money is, and that is harder to do direct action in a way that's really direct, that's not cooperating with the problem itself, right?
Right.
So I think in that kind of situation, it's especially important that we use creativity, that we use spiritual grounding, that we find other ways to capture people's attention and to demonstrate what it is that we're trying to do. So that's something that I have found really helpful in using direct action for this kind of campaign.
Yeah, I think that's so helpful because I suspect that a lot of people, I would say myself included, oftentimes we look at this, all of these large systemic things that are happening in, like you're saying, in these ways that we can't directly intervene in the electronic transfer of funds. And so how do we engage with it in a positive way? And you all are exploring that and discovering ways to do that. And how would you describe the nonviolent action that you do as an expression of your spirituality as a Quaker?
You know, a friend of mine, Lena Blunt, who's also on the Equate board, who's in her mid-20s, said something recently that rang true for me. She said, "I do this campaign so I can be in spiritual integrity." And I think that's a good way to describe it. When you feel called to do something and don't do it, there is a kind of cost. And I think the same is true of intuition. Like, if you have an intuition and you don't follow it, it's hard to measure what that cost is, but it feels like you're just knocked off of alignment a little bit. So I think that's part of it. I would say also that my experience of prayer in action has been really profound. And there's nothing that focuses your attention quite like being in a direct action situation. Mm-hmm. I go to Quaker meeting regularly. When I'm not traveling for my work, I'm there every week, where we sit in silence. And the idea is just that each person and together collectively, we connect to the divine, whatever that means to people, prayer or worship. People use different language, but, and I've certainly had very profound experiences of worship sitting on a bench in a room with other people. But I've also had many weeks, honestly, where I sit down and I start thinking, oh, I forgot to put the laundry on the line. Oh, I forgot to, you know, the monkey yeah. mind that Buddhists talk about. But when you're with a group of people in the middle of a civil disobedience action and the police are waiting to arrest you and someone calls for silent prayer, I find that to be a very focusing experience. or other times where we've, you know, prepared for action with prayer or things like that. So there is something just in the work itself that has been a really important part of my spiritual journey.
Yeah. As you're speaking, I'm remembering the first time that I was arrested doing civil disobedience. It was way back during the arms race, and I was part of a faith group. It was a faith and resistance gathering in Wyoming, and we went to the Air Force base. This was what we were focusing on, were all the MX missiles that were hidden in silos all across the, you know, central states of the country. And I tell you, Eileen, the moment when we crossed, and we were singing Amazing Grace, it was a very windy day, you know, out on the plains of Wyoming. And as we crossed the line onto the Air Force base, and of course the, you know, the officers were on the other side waiting to arrest us, the only word that really for me sufficed to describe what that experience was like was sacramental. Mm. I felt like there was something sacramental happening, and we were standing for something that was bigger than any of us individually. Mm. And it was just such a powerful experience. And so when you talk about that in those moments when the focus then is put on the spiritual implications of what's going on. It's so powerful. It's just incredible. That's been my experience anyway.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. That's a beautiful story. I was just going to add that I believe in nonviolent direct action as a strategy, and I think it can be used by all kinds of groups, but I have felt a special power when it's combined with a spiritual orientation or a spiritual grounding. And that doesn't necessarily mean talking about theology at all. It can just be through singing or silence or things that are very welcoming of people, regardless of how they define themselves. But there is something different when that spirit is there that I think makes it particularly effective, as well as being moving personally.
Yeah, I agree. So as you've embarked on this journey, what are some of the ways in which you feel like you have changed or grown?
Yeah, I'm much more, you know, I don't think most people would have described me as someone who bit my tongue a lot in the past. But I think that I did. I think that there have been lots of times where, especially around gender issues, where I kind of went along with a way of doing things that I didn't really agree with. When I look back, and some of that has to do with the stuff that's come up around the Me Too movement, you know, looking back over our lives and, you know, how we interacted with professors or what have you. But in many other ways too, I think I cared about being liked more than a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about direct action is you have to be okay with making some people uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was new to Equate, I went to a party at a board member's house, and she was playing the piano. And I said, oh, wow, you know, that was really good, after she finished. And she goes, oh, I hate playing the piano in public, but if I'm going to do direct action around climate change, I have to get used to doing uncomfortable things in public. So I'm practicing.
And that's like, great. So she's finding ways to practice stepping into her own discomfort.
Right, right. And because I've been doing this, I've noticed that I'm more at ease, kind of stepping out of line in other situations. I went to a movie a while back where the projector wasn't working, and it was actually a film about the Japanese internment. And the audience was full of people who cared about that issue, who were, and this was a little closer to the election of Donald Trump. And so it felt very live for people, right? Like, you know, the Muslim ban and things like that. It was an audience full of people who shared that concern. And nobody was getting up to go report that the projector wasn't working. And I was like in the back, in the middle. So I really was kind of hoping someone else would do it. And no one was. And I thought, wow, we're so conditioned to just sit and wait quietly. This is exactly how it happened, right? And so I just got up and, you know, told someone and they fixed the problem. And I sort of got like all these smiles and thank yous when I came back in. And I was like, wow, we're the people who have to say no if something like this happens again. We need to practice getting out of our seats even when, you know, it's a little awkward.
Just our daily lives give us all kinds of opportunities to practice stepping into that role of being the change that brings the change. Yeah.
I think that's true. Yeah.
Now, what has, this is sort of a similar question, but have there been any surprises along the way that where things happened or you discovered things about yourself or the way things work that really surprised you?
Yeah, one surprise about myself came from a conversation around conflict. We were founded by Philadelphia Quakers who are not all white, but a majority are, and our group reflected those demographics. The new campaign that we were starting has a racial justice component to it, which was one of the things that came up for people in that first session. Brainstorming about what we wanted to do. We wanted to do something that more actively addressed racial justice. And early on, there was a lot of kind of angst about like, well, are we too white to do this? Do we need to go find more people of color to join our group? How are we going to manage this dynamic? And we consulted with a woman who does a lot of work with white people around these kinds of issues. And she said to us, you're not ready to take this issue on because you haven't learned how to have conflict with each other. That especially middle class culture on top of predominantly white culture tends to be very conflict averse. And I think that's really true of Quakers, I have to say, even though we were begun in a context that included a lot of conflict. I think contemporary Quakers tend to want to be nice to everybody and don't always speak up within our own circles in the ways that we could. And so the leadership of Equate committed to trying to have more conflict with each other to hone these skills, with the thought that, like, as we grow this campaign, if we attract more racial diversity and class diversity, it'll be easier for us to deal with any issues that come up around that, but we'll also be a more welcoming space to people whose cultural background might have been more welcoming of conflict. So anyway, this was the context, and we had this conversation where somebody, you know, really put forth, like, we need to argue with each other more. And I went home and cried and cried and cried. And I was like, oh my gosh, what is this? What is happening? And what it got me in touch with was this strong aversion to conflict that came from my family upbringing. An Irish, actually working class family. but the way, you know, some of my relatives dealt with conflict was you just stop speaking to people. And maybe you'll go to their funeral in 20 years or something. And I didn't realize that I was carrying that scar or that it was affecting my social change work. But this whole series of conversations really helped me look at, what do I believe about love? What do I believe about truthfulness? What do I believe about safety and resilience? And it was a really important shift. And I want to also say that we're at a moment where our country is so polarized that those conversations are in some ways scarier, in some ways more necessary. But also, I think that when we're talking about extreme difference of opinion, I want to add that it's speaking our truth. It's not demonizing the other.
Right.
I think that that's a growing edge for me with a lot of people in my life who saw the last election really differently than I did. You know, how do I be truthful and not just come in as know-it-all, judgmental, writing people off,
right.
But also not, like, just there's a lot of discernment around what you say to whom when, that I feel like I'm still learning about this.
Right. And also there's this aspect of, well, like you're saying, not demonizing or dehumanizing those who see things differently. And that element of being able to listen deeply to where they're coming from, and creating that atmosphere of safety, it's a challenge. It can be a challenge. So you actually teach nonviolence. You have an online course on nonviolence. Can you talk to us about that? And is it available for people to sign up for?
Oh, absolutely. It's available. The next round starts in May. In fact, I have two online classes, and the nonviolent one grew out of the first one, which really was another intuition immediately after the election. I had been kind of vaguely thinking, oh, someday maybe I should teach an online class. And the morning after the election, I went to Quaker silent worship at my community and just had this really strong sense of, it's time to teach that class.
Mm-hmm.
So all I did was post it on Facebook, and I had like 180 people in the first round. And that class is called We Were Made for This Moment, and it's sort of looks at the big picture of how does social change happen, what are some of the different approaches, and then journaling to help people discern, well, what is my role? What am I called to? Out of that, some of the people in the first class said, would you offer one specifically on nonviolent direct action, which I think more people are feeling drawn to in this time period. And so for people who aren't sure what that means, think Gandhi, think the movement for women's suffrage and the civil rights movement, people acting nonviolently, but as we said, in a really focused way and challenging injustice or challenging powerful institutions that are not doing what they should. And so that class also, both of them I'm running again in May, is called Building a Nonviolent Direct Action Campaign. And both of them you can take as an individual, or there's a special discount for groups that take the class together.
Okay, and they can find information on your website, eileenflanagan.com, right?
That's correct. There's a online courses tab, and you can read about the difference between the two.
And are there any closing words of wisdom that you would like to offer us, or, I don't know, anything that you'd like to say before we wrap things up?
I think we're in a time where we really need spiritual grounding and we really need bold action. And I don't see the divisions or the conflicts that we're in now disappearing. Even if the cast of characters in the White House changes, I don't think the more fundamental issues are going away. And so it's part of what I love about teaching these classes. I think a lot of people sense it. A lot of people, whether they're young or old and have been doing things for a long time, sense like we're in a new moment. Something more is called of me. you know, how can I figure out what it is? And I just want to encourage people in those inquiries, because I think it's true. I think we're, you know, there's a lot of transformational change that's needed. And I really appreciate the chance to talk to you about it today, Patricia, because I think that people are hungry for these kind of conversations.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's weighing, to use a Quaker terminology, it's weighing on a lot of us, the issue. Just, you know, being in these times that are, they really are calling us into a different way, a different way of being. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again, Eileen, so much, and for being with us and sharing your experience and your wisdom. And I really encourage listeners to check out Eileen's website, where you will find information on her courses and on her books. And also, she offers talks. So if you're part of a group that would be interested in having her speak, you can find out more information on her website as well. And that's eileenflanagan.com. Well, thank you again, Eileen, and peace.
Peace to you, Patricia.